Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Freshly Booked on One Radio. Join us as we interview authors just beginning their literary journey. It doesn't matter how their book is published, the world agrees being a published author is a big step. We want to celebrate and spotlight these writers whose words were brought into the hands of readers. Listen in as they talk about their new experiences and join us in jubilation for those who are Freshly Booked.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Freshly Booked. This is our first episode of April. We took a little hiatus for Easter, but we're glad to have you back. Today, I have Darren Kennedy with me on the line. He was born and raised in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and is a graduate of Wake Forest University and Bowman Gray School of Medicine. After completing his family medicine residency in the mountains of Virginia, he served 8 years as United States Army physician and wrote his first novel in 2003 in the sands of northern Iraq. His debut novel, The Mussorgsky Riddle, was born from a fusion of two of his lifelong loves, classical music and world mythology. His short stories can be found in various publications, and he is currently hard at work on his next novel. So, Darren, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, we got to know you just a little bit through your bio about working in the armed forces. First of all, thank you so much for your sacrifice and working for our country. I greatly appreciate that.
Oh, thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
I was born in North Carolina, and pretty much I was in the Winston-Salem area all the way through the end of medical school. Then I've kind of been all over the place since. I've settled back into the Charlotte, North Carolina area where my day job is I practice family medicine and teach family medicine residents, sort of training the next generation of doctors. But I've always had a thing for storytelling, I think, since I was a wee kid, and people would ask me, so what happened in this movie? And then 20 minutes later, they were very sorry they ever asked that question. So my night job is making books, and my first one is out now.
That is great. Well, how did you start writing?
How did I start writing? Well, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, I was in northern Iraq in Mosul, where we were living in a MiG hangar, which is the hangar where the Russian-type jets, the Iraqi Air Force, used to have before Operation Desert Storm made them no longer have an Air Force way back in the 90s. And so we literally had moved into an old Iraqi Air Force base. I was living in a MiG hangar, staying with the dentist, because we were with the medical group in our unit. And I had always wanted to write this other story, which is another novel I've written, we're still seeking a home for. But I had always wanted to write this story, and so pretty much on a daily basis, when the dentist wasn't using his Panasonic Toughbook to record dental exams and take x-rays, I would borrow it, I would work on this novel, and I would save it all to my little thumb drive. And by the time we were leaving Iraq, I had that thumb drive pieced together with some duct tape so that I wouldn't lose it. But I got that novel back from Iraq to the U.S., and that was actually the novel that landed me my agent. And then subsequently, I started working on the Mussorgsky Riddle, and that is the novel that we're talking about today, which is the second full novel that I've written.
You kind of remind me of MacGyver back from the 80s on the television show. You can kind of just pretty much take anything and make anything. That sounds really neat.
Part of your job, especially a doctor in the middle of the desert, is to, you know, make great-tasting soup out of minimal ingredients, I guess, on a metaphorical level.
I love it. I love cooking illiteracy, so that just works great for me. What authors would you say inspire your writing?
If I could be anyone, and I'm sure a lot of people say this, but I mean, I really dig Neil Gaiman. His stuff just always speaks to me. American Gods, Neverwhere. I really liked The Ocean at the End of the Lane. I just finished that one about a year ago. I believe that was his latest. I'm not sure if he's got anything. Oh, he does have the new one out that I haven't purchased yet. But yeah, I'm a big Gaiman fan, and I've read far more Stephen King than is probably healthy. But I'm a big Dark Tower fan, and I've always said I wish that I had written The Dark Tower. So unfortunately, it's already been written, so I'm working on my own things.
Right. Well, Flit, have you ever joined any writer, any like local writers groups or anything like that?
Sure. When I was still in the Army down in Columbus, Georgia, I briefly joined a writer critique group that met at the local Barnes & Noble. So when I got to Charlotte about 6 years ago, back in 2009, I was looking for a new critique group, and a very cool guy named Brendan McKennedy, about 6 months before I got here, had started a group called Charlotte Writers, which at the time was a lot of literary fiction writers and poets who would get together and critique each other's stuff about twice a month. I joined, a few other people joined, and we were a little bit more of the genre fiction type. We had one horror writer, one sort of wicked humorist, science fiction, fantasy, mystery writer, and then me, who sort of dabbles in contemporary fantasy and paranormal mystery. And so the three of us joined, and then over time, I would say that the group has shifted a little bit in the genre fiction direction, but Brendan ran it from 2009 to 2010. Then I took over and actually ran that group from 2011 to 2012, and now it's under new leadership. It's under the sort of the third regime, and trying to keep going and helping young writers in the Charlotte area learn basically the basic skills or the more advanced skills if they're a little bit further along. And it's a great place to meet other writers.
That's great.
Writers like to hang out with writers.
Yes, we do. That seems to be the group of people we tend to flock to. I found that out through working with NaNoWriMo. And we tend to find each other no matter where we go. We always find a writer of some type. Have any of your real-life experiences ever influenced your writing?
I would say everybody's real life experiences always influences your writing, either directly or indirectly. People have always asked me, "Oh, you're a writer. Do you write medical stuff like anybody that we've heard of?" And I'm like, "No, I don't write about that stuff. I live it every day." "Oh, well, you were in the Army. Do you write Army stuff?" I'm like, "No, I live that every day too. I tend to write things that are a little bit more outside." However, I do like to think that whenever I do write a medical scene, that it's pretty darn accurate. In my first novel, I have, you know, a guy being brought into the emergency room who's just been a victim of gunshot wounds, and I've taken care of those people. So I know what that looks, sounds, smells like, and what the doctors would actually be doing in the ER.
That's really great that you have that type of background and you can bring that to life. I know a lot of people like to see stuff like that on the television, but to read it in a book, it's a lot different. So I think that's really great that you've been able to use your experiences there. Tell me a little bit about researching for your books.
Researching for my books is It's very interesting. My first book had a lot to do with chess, and so I was having to, from our limited internet in Iraq, research the entire history of chess back 1,500 years and print out, you know, just copious amounts of paper trying to read up on that. And then the new book is the Mussorgsky Riddle, and it's all about the main shift of the story is a 13-year-old boy that's lost inside his own mind and the psychic that's got to go in there and find him. But it's told over the backdrop of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, which is a classical music suite written in the late 1800s. And so I was already very familiar with the music, but I had to research him and then the paintings that influenced him done by Victor Hartmann. I researched the life of Victor Hartmann and then a lot of their fellow composers like Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky, and trying to wrap my brain around it. And I got paid a very high compliment in an interview that I did a couple months ago. I believe they said he talks like he got his doctorate from Juilliard instead of Bowman Gray School of Medicine. I was like, oh, that was a really nice thing to say.
That is really nice. It means you're dead on. That's great. Okay, I love to ask this question to other writers because everybody writes in their own different style, but do you carefully plot out what you write are you just write it as it comes to you?
So there's actually an article on my blog called Plotter versus Pantser. I call myself a plantser. I'm a little bit of both. I generally know I think I'm more of a pantser than a plotter, but I definitely know where the story is going, especially like if you write a story that's based on a classical music suite and it has defined movements, like first there is the gnome, then there's the old castle. I mean, you kind of have it mapped out for you. And then the new one that I'm working on also has sort of a framework that I'm having to follow to sort of keep up with the composer I'm working with now. But as far as like knowing exactly what's going to happen in every chapter, the funny thing I always tell people about Mussorgsky is the whodunit changed, I think, at least four times from my first word until I finished the book. I think that I was discovering what was happening as much as the reader is. And I think that doing it that way, for me at least, makes it a little bit fresher. And I mean, my red herrings are pretty good because at one point they actually were the person who did it.
So that's great. I love to sit down with a mystery book, and through the whole entire book, I'm reading and I'm thinking, okay, maybe it could be this person, maybe it could be this person, maybe it could be this person. And by the end of the book, 9 times out of 10, I'm usually wrong. Probably for the wrong reason. So I love the idea that you honestly didn't know who was going to do it because you changed your pattern. I think that's awesome.
The very first person.
How did you come up with? No, go ahead.
I would say the very first person who was going to be the one that did the bad thing actually is no longer even in the book, which I think is really funny. He was written completely out. I was like, nah, I don't need that guy.
That's taken down the editing road. Nope, you're cut.
You're out of here, man.
You see that on a lot of starting actors and things when they had like tiny little parts, their little parts got thrown out in edits. That is really cute.
That's got to be heartbreaking. I can't even imagine that. Here
comes
my
scene. You'll
have
to tell the story from that character's point of view later.
That would be your Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead moment.
Yeah, exactly. Tell everybody how you came up with the title for your book.
Well, so I was busy working on the sequel to the first novel of mine that I'm still looking for a home for. And whenever I was working on that, I was also listening to a lot of classical music. I was listening to Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov, but I really got into pictures in an exhibition by way of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, who are a very good sort of progressive rock band from the 70s. So they did a version of Pictures in Exhibition that was sort of a rock version. Then I ended up, when I was still living in Columbus, going to see an orchestral version of that done. And I'd always wanted to hear what the original music sounded like, and then I really liked it, so I got the CD. I listened to it approximately 4.3 billion times and really dug it. And then one day I just happened to be looking at the back of the CD case, and as I was looking at all the different movement titles, like The Gnome, The Old Castle, The Tuileries Garden, I was just like, those sound so much like chapter titles to me. And they are. They're chapter titles of a piece of music. But I was like, that needs to be a book. And then I had to write a book. Basically, I wrote this book because I wanted to write a book about Pictures in Exhibition. And the title is called The Mussorgsky Riddle, because Mussorgsky is the composer of that piece of music, and it's a riddle because it's a mystery.
That is great. I absolutely love that. I don't know of anybody who has sat down to write a story based on just solely on music like that. That is incredible. Can you tell us a little bit about your main characters?
The main characters? Sure. So if you decide that you want to write a story about a piece of music that's also going to have the history of the music and the influence behind the music, and you're going to try to get all that in a book, I thought about it and thought about it, and whenever I really put my mind to it, I was like, where is the only place that music and art and history can all sort of be combined to where you can look at it? And I said that would probably be inside of someone's mind, because that's where art and music and history is all appreciated. And then I said, And if the story is occurring in someone's mind, then who is the only person that can walk that exhibition? And it would have to be a psychic. And so then I was like, so I've got a psychic and I've got all of this going on in somebody's head. Who are these people? And so I said, and why would you go in there in the first place? And so I said, well, what if you had a 13-year-old boy whose mind, for whatever reason, and you'll find out when you read the book, has just splintered into all of the different pictures in an exhibition, and as a result, he's comatose, catatonic, can't talk, can't do anything, and then the psychic comes and to check him out and gets pulled in there. And so that's why my main two characters are the 13-year-old boy, Anthony, who is virtually catatonic, and then my main character is Mira Theodore. She's Latina, in her early 30s, has a 7-year-old daughter back home in Georgetown, but she drives all the way down to Charlotte and spends a week with this family trying to figure out Anthony and what the heck's going on with him. And I literally threw everything from every facet of her life at her that I could at the same time to make her have a very miserable week. But she did okay.
She survived.
She somehow survived. Spoiler, she survived.
When did your first release come out?
January 12th of this year. So we've been out a little over 3 months. And I've been very fortunate to be able to do a few different book signings, and I've got lined up to do various, of all things, science fiction conventions. I'm going to go to 5 of them this year, so it's pretty exciting. I get to be on panels and talk to fans and meet really cool, interesting people, often dressed in really cool, interesting costumes. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that does sound like a lot of fun. Now, you had a book signing last night in Winston-Salem, right?
Yep. Hometown signing was yesterday. I was in Winston-Salem, and it was awesome. My kindergarten teacher showed up for my book signing. The lady who drove me to school every day for 3 years, from 4th through 6th grade, showed up for my book signing. Friends from high school, college, medical school, from my current job, family, friends, church. I mean, literally people from all my different walks of life all drove over to the Barnes & Noble to say hi, and it was just a very cool 2 hours. I really had a good time.
That sounds so much fun. I wish I could have been there last night. We had a conflict of schedule, but I was going to show up last night. I wish I had. When is your next signing?
Oh, goodness, let me think. Well, I will be at RavenCon, which is a science fiction fantasy convention in Richmond, Virginia, all weekend next weekend. I've got let me pull up my calendar real quick.
I did catch you off guard with that one.
Oh no, that's cool. The next signing is I'll also be at Con Carolina's, which is another convention in Charlotte, the last weekend of May. The next two bookstore signings are in the same week. I've got one at the Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, North Carolina at 2 p.m. on the 7th of June. And then that Thursday night in Greensboro at Scuppernong Books, which is a really neat independent bookstore that I got to visit in downtown Greensboro. But I'll be there on 11 June at 7 p.m. And looking forward to both of those very much.
Yeah, so if you guys are listening to this, you need to go meet him, get him to sign your book, talk to him about this. He's a very, very fascinating person. Just outside of his book, to go and visit him. Darren, will you take just a few minutes and read the excerpt that you were going to read for us today?
Oh, sure. Let me pull it back up. So as you've sort of gotten from earlier in the show, this is about Mira, who is a psychic, who's going into the mind of Anthony, who is the catatonic boy. And so the first two chapters of the book are Mira meeting Anthony's psychologist, meeting Anthony's mother, and then meeting Anthony, who's obviously not very talkative. At the end of chapter 2, she lays her fingers on his head as she's trying to sort of, because in the past she's basically been able to read emotions, but nothing like this has ever happened to her before. So at the end of chapter 2, as she's trying to get a read on him, she's actually sucked into his mind. There's a big maelstrom of color, almost like she's being attacked by a killer rainbow. And then all of a sudden, she says, "I hear you, Anthony." And then you turn the page on chapter 3, and here we go. And I will sound much more masculine than Mira does, but this is all told through her point of view. "No sooner do the words leave my lips than the barrage of light and sound stops. The sudden silence is somehow worse. Before I can take a breath, a burst of brilliance like 1,000 flashbulbs firing at once blinds me. With ears still ringing from the auditory onslaught, I rub at my eyes as my vision adjusts to the muted luminescence of another place entirely. An enormous hallway stretches out before me, the sheer opulence of the space reminding me of pictures from the Louvre. The way before me is clear, though the passage to my rear is blocked by a pair of 10-foot-high doors fashioned of dark oak. A lock the size of my head hangs between them. Won't be leaving that way. Dios mio, I mutter, channeling my mother. If even God can hear me in this place. Its walls alabaster white with mahogany trim, the hall's hardwood floor is laid in an intricate herringbone parquet pattern of alternating oak and rosewood. Above my head, the vaulted ceiling is decorated with a fresco reminiscent of the Sistine Chapels, though the style of the painter appears far more Dali than Michelangelo. Also, where David's sculptor found his inspiration in the many stories of the Bible, the tortured images that fill the ceiling of this place are all stolen from classical mythology, the entire surface an anthropologist's acid dream. Directly above me, Leda's rape by the Zeus swan fills my vision. Just adjacent, the three fates continue their eternal task of spinning, measuring, and cutting the thread of life, the product of their work resolving into a misshapen infant's umbilical cord. Prometheus, chained to the rock with the eagle's head buried in his flayed abdomen, lies in agony above the gigantic door that blocks my escape. The Titan's gaze follows me as I venture farther down the hallway, and an additional picture comes into view. Persephone rests on one knee in the darkness, her fist clutched around the crimson pomegranate that remands her to Hades for half the year. Guess that minor in classics isn't looking like such a waste of time anymore, is it, Mom? If my theory about this place is right, two things are very clear. Anthony Faircloth has an intimate knowledge of world mythology, and he's not too big on subtlety. As I proceed down the hallway, the images above me grow more and more bizarre, even as the scenes they depict become less and less familiar. In one, a spider climbs into the sky with a bound python caught between its front legs. In another, a bearded man wears a black t-shirt with a white lightning bolt like the Gatorade logo and holds aloft what appears to be a glowing baseball bat. The largest portrays a half-dead Norse warrior standing atop a fractured rainbow. A multitude of slain enemies lie at his feet. The scantily clad women that grace the covers of my brother's old heavy metal collection would look right at home next to Odin or Thor or whoever the hell Leif Erikson on steroids is supposed to be. "Have you come to weave me a tale?" The whispered voice seems to come from nowhere and everywhere at once. Of lovers and dangers and unrequited passion? Anthony? I work to keep the tremor from my voice. I fail. "I know your secret," the voice continues. "You hope to lull me with your honeyed words and clever plots." I've spoken with others mind to mind on numerous occasions in the past, a unique experience each time, to be sure. I've never been addressed this way before. "Who said that?" There's no sign of anyone else along the great hall. "Show yourself." "In due time, Scheherazade." A low chuckle fills the hall. "We will meet soon enough, I fear." "Wait." My pulse begins to race. "Where am I? What is this place?" The voice doesn't speak again. The only answer, a quiet titter that echoes down from the vaulted ceiling. I hold my breath, hoping for any clue that might help me escape this place. But an oppressive silence, unnatural in its fullness, fills the air. Neither masculine nor feminine, the whispered voice could represent an ally, but my money's on adversary. "Won't figure it out standing here," I mutter. "Time to move." As I continue my slow progress down the vast hallway, a name echoes across my psyche. Scheherazade. The voice called me Scheherazade.
That is great. That makes me want to go out and get the book now.
Excellent.
It does. Tell a couple people, or tell us where a couple places where your book is being sold. I know we've got the direct link on the show page, but in case somebody's not listening there. Where can they find your book?
Well, as always, you can find it on Amazon, both in paperback and in ebook format. And we actually made a deal to sell it to Audible. I haven't heard when that is happening, but the audiobook may be available at some point this year. I'm waiting to hear on that just like everyone else. I am available at Park Road Books in Charlotte, and so far I know of 3 Barnes & Nobles that are carrying it already. They have it on the shelf in Birkdale, in Arboretum, and the one in Winston-Salem now when they get more in since we sold out yesterday. But pretty much if you go to any independent bookstore or any Barnes & Noble and just talk to them and ask them to order it, they can order it for you and get it there within a few days. It's available.
That's
all
great.
Places to sell books.
A lot of first-time authors don't get into the big chain stores like Books A Million or Barnes & Noble. So congratulations on getting your foot in the door. That is incredible. Tell everybody where to find you online, like on your social media, your website, things like that.
Sure. I'm at darinkennedy.com. My name is D-A-R-I-N and then Kennedy, like the president. And it's just all one big word, darinkennedy.com. And there you can find my blog. I have a list of interviews, a list of reviews of the book. And if you look under events, that's where you can find me. And every time I get something new lined up, I try to keep all of that updated so that it's always up to date.
Great. Well, we only have a few more minutes, but I have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you about your book. What part of the book do you think was the easiest part to write?
Well, this particular story, half of it takes place in the real world where we all live, and half of it takes place inside of this kid's brain. And honestly, there were times where it was much more difficult. I mean, after you've written this awesome fantasy story where anything can happen and witches can ride on the back of lobster monsters and tear castles apart and, you know, gnomes can run through paintings and watercolor ballerinas can grab your brain and make you dance with them, and then to come back to the real world and have to write that, but it has to be just as interesting as what's going on in the fantasy world. So I would say the fantasy stuff was really easy to write because that's what I set out to do when I wrote this book. I'm like, I want to bring pictures at an exhibition to life. Writing the real world stuff that makes the story make sense was the more challenging part, but I worked really hard to make the real world stuff just as intriguing and interesting, just in a more of a Law and Order way and less of a Hobbit way than the fantasy story part.
Gotcha. Okay, well, we're going to reverse this. What do you think was the most difficult part for you to write? Was it more along the lines of writing in the voice of a character? Was it a particular scene? What do you think that was?
Most difficult part. One thing is, I wrote this whole thing in first-person present tense from the point of view of a 30-something-year-old woman. And so putting Mira on, I thought was going to be really difficult, but actually she talks to me pretty well, which I really appreciate, because otherwise it'd be really difficult to tell this story correctly. There were a few times where, I don't know, I always, at about the three-fifths to four-fifths point in the book, I always come to I'm not sure what happens next. And so I would say the hardest part of writing this would be, this has happened literally in every book I've written so far. I get to about 60 to 70% in, and I'm like, I'm not sure. That's the one problem with being a pantser is you have to, if the story's not coming to you, you're going to have to like go think about it in a different framework and then come back to it. So I think the hardest part was getting over my usual Kennedy hump at about just past the halfway point.
Well, thank you so much, Darin, for being here with us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing your book and your background and your knowledge of music. This has been an incredible interview, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fantastic.
Sure. Well, next week you guys can tune back into us. We actually have an interview on Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and then again on Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. So you guys can tune in then. Thanks so much for being with us, and keep reading.